Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's About Time for True Crime. Hi.
Hey, guys.
How are
you? How you doing? Happy Tuesday or any day that ends in Y that you're listening on.
Happy listening day and a happy belated Mother's Day to all the mamas in the ATFDC fam.
Happy Mother's Day. Hope you had a day of self-care and fun and maybe you got to hang in your jammies.
Yeah, and hang out with the loving little kiddos or pod pets that you have.
Yeah, little rugrats running around.
A special shout out, happy Mother's Day to Mrs. Abel Dabelson and Mrs. Allie's mom. We love you.
We love you very much.
And thank you, because if you didn't birth us, we couldn't birth this.
Yay.
Yay. The ATFDC grandmamas.
Yes. Okay, that's adorable.
We hope you guys had a great celebration. Anybody who is celebrating. And for those of you who might have had a hard one, that you are having a really good spring.
Yep. And you're taking care of yourself. You're practicing good self-care regardless. Go on your hot girl walks.
Love a hot girl walk. We just took one today.
We did. And we did it in the rain.
So.
And we felt like Snow White. We saw a bunny and we saw lots of birdies.
And
we
doggies. Saw
dogs and little chipmunks that looked abso-frickin-lutely adorable.
Yes. Well, I've told you all that I'm an old woman. And I guess to continue that trend, I like to follow the Facebook pages where they put little like wildlife cams up around. And it's like time that all the little bird eggs are hatching. And so there's all these little updates of like, look, one of the eggs hatched here and one of them hatched here. And I'm like, ah.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds good.
You can become definitely emotionally invested in that. I dig that.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
I could see that.
They're my local David Attenborough. Speaking of, Planet Earth 3 came out lately, so you know I got plans to watch that.
It did?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I saw it when, not to drop a little hint here, I was watching all of the Karen Reed HBO documentary. So.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
Yes.
All right, we're going to have a Planet Earth night.
But that's really all that's going on here. We're just kind of hanging in, chugging along.
I think we're ready to get into this because we're at our final part here.
Yeah, we are. So, without further ado. Yoo-hoo! Pod's on.
Oh, you guys.
We're here for part three.
Yes. So, hi, hello, and welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
That's us.
We've done it, folks. We have arrived at our third and final part of John List. I am nearly ready to retire this 30-page document of research that I have in front of me. I definitely enjoyed researching it, but it's good to get it out.
I can relate. There's a point at the end of like a long series where you're like, I've done what I can do here, kids.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta be done.
Yep. Everything is out on the table after this part. And you guys have stuck around for several hours of all of this. But I did quickly want to acknowledge that we did something we don't usually do in our Instagram post for part two.
Ooh.
I included a photo of the crime scene.
Got
specifically
it.
The ballroom where the bodies were lined up on those sleeping bags. And we don't typically do that. In fact, we usually encourage that if you want to see something like that, feel free to look it up yourself. I did put a warning photo beforehand so that no one would get like taken by surprise by that. It's not something I want to catch off guard. And it isn't particularly gory, but it's unsettling. It's upsetting, of course. And I didn't post that for shock value, but so much of what we talk about in this series is John.
Right.
Obviously. But we know relatively little about the lives of those that he killed, and what happened to them was terrifying, violent, calculated, and ruthless, coming from a son, father, and husband, no less. But I don't want what happened to them to be lost in the tale of his life,
right,
or to be glossed over because the murders happened in a matter of minutes. And really, I mean, he killed Alma and Helen within maybe 10-ish minutes. The kids in a matter of minutes when they got home. I mean, this was rapid fire, and I don't mean that, like, pun intended, but I mean, like, hours passed between the kids coming home, but the actual murders themselves were maybe 20 minutes total.
Yeah, I was going to say it's really interesting that the day of it was so drawn out, but none of the killings were. Like, right. The individual murders were, I mean, it was really like he just wanted to be done. There was no sadism involved. There was no torture, nothing like that.
Exactly. There's no, like, bloodthirsty ritual or torture or, like, making people confess or say anything. I mean, he quite literally caught them by surprise.
Yeah.
And just ended it all.
It is a haunting photo, but it is not gory in any way.
Yes. But John just decided they shouldn't live anymore, and he was the man to make that happen. And I think the gravity of what he did, because unfortunately, outside of what he did here, he would probably be like a 10 out of 10 neighbor.
Oh, yeah.
He would be somebody that you wouldn't not invite to the barbecue. You just know he wouldn't show.
Right.
You know, there are other aspects of his life that don't come off as horrid, but what he did and the way he disposed of his family, because he saw to it that that's how it should be, is it shouldn't be lost, and it shouldn't be anything that's glossed over or anything. So I kind of wanted that as the reminder of, like, this is why we're talking about this. This, though it happened in a matter of minutes, it was a brutal, evil matter of minutes. And it is important to talk about. But at the same time, it's also incredibly important, in my opinion, to talk about what he did afterwards and how he evaded capture. And because knowledge is power and information can guide us in making safe decisions. And as you know, Abby and I are just big nerds who want to learn and grow and gain new perspectives and learn from what others have done and piece together how we can prevent it from happening again.
Well, and in so many cases, I don't want to say like this, because I don't mean just familicide. I don't mean men who kill their families. Mm-hmm. I just mean in homicide, murder in general. Like, so much of what we know about the crime is from what we take from before and after.
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing if he's going out of his mind, losing his cool every day, like freaking out about it, or if he is cool and refreshed and, you know, starts anew in a new job and, you know, goes about his life like it never happened, or any number of things can really tell us a lot about how they personally feel about what they did, and then in turn, like, what truly happened.
Right. Like, what the impact was to him in his life, but also, I mean, what do you do?
Right.
I mean, you think of Dolores, what do you do? And we're going to talk all about her, but...
Which I can only imagine.
It haunting. But last episode, we covered the initial discovery of the bloody scene.
Yes.
The investigation that followed, which unfortunately went nowhere fast. And frankly, those boots on the ground there, that wasn't their fault. There really wasn't anything to go off of. There was no indicator or predictor where he would have gone. He didn't leave any of that behind.
Right.
While law enforcement worked on the case, John had turned a new leaf. Bob Clark, as he was going by, left New England and moved to Colorado and slowly began rebuilding. He met a woman named Dolores. The two dated and then married.
Mm-hmm.
Soon, John happened upon a similar pattern as he had with Helen. He married Dolores. They began to have financial troubles. They grew a bit tired of each other. He never addressed anything wrong. He never communicated. And short of merely relocating to Colorado and changing his name, John did nothing to conceal himself. He dressed the same. He went to the same kind of church. He behaved the same. He worked accounting jobs, even though he was a terrible accountant. And largely, he led the same life repeated.
Yeah.
Wanda Flannery, Dolores, and Bob's neighbor, first felt pity, and then that pity turned to suspicion when she read an article in the Weekly World News about John List and the murder of his entire family. When we left you in part two, Wanda was still a strong believer that Bob Clark was John List, but she wasn't the only one. John List was on the brain of several people. Many of those Westfield law enforcement hadn't abandoned all hope yet,
mm-hmm.
but there were a few with an idea.
Oh.
A police captain named Frank Maronka from Westfield, New Jersey, was still working the case. The case was also being investigated by the FBI, I believe he was on their most wanted list, as they knew John wasn't in New Jersey anymore, and fleeing the state with these kinds of charges certainly made this federal.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators were still hard at work trying to track down John List, but Captain Maranka suggested that they send the case in to America's Most Wanted.
Ooh.
But America's Most Wanted didn't want to cover it.
America's Most Wanted said, "That's very interesting, but I'm not interested."
Yes.
Yes.
They felt like the case was too old, that it wasn't worth it, and that it couldn't possibly yield any results, which to that I say there's only one way to find out.
Yep.
And if you don't know, we'll talk about America's Most Wanted, but just know that this was pitched and it was
turned down.
Yep, sent right back with a thanks but no thanks. Meanwhile, the neighborhood in Colorado that Bob and Dolores lived in was getting worse and worse. They had a 2-bedroom apartment that was starting to feel too small, but also crime in their area was increasing. Property values plummeted. One report stated, and this is very upsetting, I'm sorry, that their dog was killed outside their home.
Oh.
And this was the last straw. They had to move. Now, I only saw that reported like one place, so I don't know if it was theirs or a neighbor's or if that even happened at all. I want to tell myself it didn't happen at all. But all of that to say that the area that they had been living in for a few years just slowly became like, I don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah.
After Wanda had confronted Dolores with her suspicions, Dolores said that she'd ask Bob about it.
Okay.
So she heard Wanda out. Wanda was very adamant, I think this is your husband. Dolores was like, no, sweetie, my husband's name is Bob, not John.
Yeah.
I'm making that up. I have no idea.
He's a sweet, benign fellow.
Yeah, he's sweet. He wouldn't hurt a fly. Look at him. But still, Dolores just wrote her off and she threw out the paper.
Got it.
And she never did confront Bob about it. She was completely closed off to the possibility that it could be true. Just didn't acknowledge it. But finally, Bob landed a job. Remember how he was struggling to find employment as he, you know, had done as John List as well?
Yeah.
Well, he did actually find a job, but this one would make them relocate.
Okay.
So they moved to Richmond, Virginia, and John List headed back east.
Okay.
They moved in February 1988.
Okay.
Mind you, the murders happened in 1971.
So, a solid 17 years later.
Yes. His freedom could drive.
A lifetime later.
Correct.
Yeah.
Detective Jeffrey Hummel disagreed with many of his colleagues. Most had assumed John List must be dead because he never resurfaced. And also, I don't know if that was just the view at the time, but at least statistically, we know now that in most familicides, if it's the father murdering his family, they often take their life at the end as well. They are the last to go.
Right.
So the assumption was that maybe he did it, but he did it elsewhere. But like, you probably won't be finding him.
Right. And, you know, not every case is average, clearly, but statistically likely.
Mm-hmm.
More likely than not, for sure.
And he never did resurface. It's not like they saw him or there were tips coming in. Despite their efforts, a lot of them had said, maybe he is dead. But a lot of them also said maybe he's not.
Right, because if they knew about his age when this happened, which I'm sure they did, because they knew about John List, mm-hmm. then they would know that he's well within the average life expectancy still. And also, like, this is 1988. Like, you know, the 70s to the 80s. This mm-hmm. is not, like, today technology. They're not running fingerprints in a national database when he starts a job or like
right.
following up Instagrams with facial recognition technology
or confirming his resume. Like, why did his resume not exist before 1971?
Right. Can you explain that gap?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And if he was born in 25, he was what, 46 when he murdered his family?
Right.
So he is, you know, 47 going for these jobs. What, I mean, he had the history that he just picked up working in restaurants in Colorado.
Right.
Okay. Little different than the accounting gig you had before. And maybe you should have stuck with it because you suck at it, but whatever. It's just my opinion.
Apparently you were a great chef, but bad at crunching the numbers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Jeffrey Hummel, Detective Jeffrey Hummel, never saw evidence to confirm that John was dead.
Right.
And therefore, he just wasn't buying it. So he thought he was still alive and he was in hiding.
Well, we love that because it was true.
Correct. He pored over the old case files, but there was nothing. And really, there wasn't anything. There was nothing left at the house that would give you any indication that John List was going to change his name to Bob Clark and end up in Colorado.
Right.
I mean, why would anybody think that? It was like he threw a dart at a map of the U.S. and was like, that's it, I'll go there. He was seemingly in the wind. And of course, investigators were discouraged by this, but this guy had a different approach, and I kind of dig it. He knew of a psychic that had consulted in past cases and whose readings had been shockingly accurate. I don't tend to think of a detective believing in that, and I find it very interesting that he turned to her and asked for her help.
Yeah.
So he sat with her, and they spent 2 hours together going over crime scene photos. And this psychic, Elizabeth Lerner, had some interesting things to say.
Okay.
She said that John List was alive and had not traveled by plane. So presuming that where he'd left his car, he had maybe taken a train or a bus, but he didn't hop on a plane.
Right.
Which is true. He actually did take a train from New York to Colorado.
Okay.
She predicted that there was a new woman involved in his life that had some connection with Baltimore, Maryland.
Interesting.
Dolores actually was from Baltimore.
Okay.
She said that he fled to the Southwest, which was true.
Yeah.
From New Jersey. Okay. And that there was some significance with Florida or Virginia.
All right.
Which Virginia is where he did ultimately end up. So this was pretty significant.
Right.
And I want to say that it was her or maybe somebody else that suggested that he would return to Westfield on the anniversary.
Interesting.
Like he would go to the cemetery where they were laid to rest and that he would like visit their gravestone, which I believe for several years or maybe just the one. But they actually did have, like, somebody watching the grave site.
Interesting.
On the just to see if anybody would go on the anniversary, and John never showed. He didn't go. But I think that was one of the predictions that she or somebody else had, and there was enough weight in it, or at least they probably just said, fuck it, we'll give it a shot. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? We spend a few hours of, like, overtime money, like, to catch a man who murdered his entire family?
To multiple lives.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm okay with my tax dollars going there personally.
Yeah.
So.
That is impressive.
Pretty significant guidance. Now, they don't know that this is true. This was all confirmed afterwards. But ideally, this was to guide them in the right direction. Like, okay, what's the significance with Florida or Virginia? I don't know how she got those two.
Right.
But Virginia was relevant.
Well, and as someone who typically, personally, like, I err on the side of skepticism. You know, some of that makes sense to me, right? Like, okay, he's not going to fly by plane. Well, that makes sense because he probably has to have an ID to fly by plane.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be another woman. Well, yeah, he's got mommy issues up the ass, and he's got, like, interesting codependent relationships with the women in his life. That being said, the locations, very curious to me.
It is. And I'm a weirdo. Where, like, I don't doubt what I don't understand.
Yeah.
And I think psychics are real. I think the vast majority of people that call themselves that are cons. But I think that some people have incredible abilities and can tap into something that not everybody can. But I think a lot of people that are like, well, for $500, I can tell you,
My skepticism goes up greatly when you're trying to take money. That being said, I don't doubt that they could be out there. And clearly, like, this woman had some inclination or intuition of something.
Oh, I think she was probably getting paid. But it's like, yeah, if that's how you make your living, like, that's your skill. Hell yeah. But if I'm going to pay you $1,000 for you to tell me, like, what's the significance of December to you? It's like, well, it's Christmas. I always loved Christmas. She's right. Like, I knew that.
You have a 1 in 12 chance of having something.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like, well, my grandfather was born. You know what I mean? It's just like, all right. Pipe down, you know what I mean? Where there are some things, but in this particular case, it seemed very telling, very interesting. You can read more about it if you go to Crime Library.
And I do like that the detective said, let me hear you out.
I mean,
again, yeah, like multiple times.
And it's not like any of that needs to be actionable, but it is something.
Right.
So we'll take something.
Sure.
But unfortunately, this detective was transferred.
Oh.
And he ended up in the narcotics unit and had to let the investigation go.
Okay.
And reluctantly he did, but with the request that any case updates, please be brought to him too.
Okay.
So if anything comes up, please notify me, even though this isn't my wheelhouse anymore.
Yeah, I want to know. I'm invested.
Then he saw an episode of America's Most Wanted and he went to Captain Maranka, and thus that's where they wanted to approach the show and see if their story could be, you know, see if they could get on the show. And that's when they were told no that time.
Interesting.
But in 1989, they pitched the idea again, this time to producers in person.
Ooh.
And got their buy-in. America's Most Wanted agreed to cover the case.
Hell yeah.
And if you've lived under a true crime rock, that's okay. We're learning together. Maybe you don't know what America's Most Wanted is, and that's okay, babe. We're here for you. But America's Most Wanted was a TV show that had millions and millions of viewers who tuned in to hear, usually John Walsh, provide overviews of cases, evidence, and suspects, and enlist the help of the American public to catch the criminals. John Walsh is most recognizable as the host of this show and others like In Pursuit with John Walsh and The Hunt with John Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
But he became a known figure in part because of his own tragedy. His son, his beautiful six-year-old Adam, was abducted from a mall in July of 81. Adam was there with his mom when she let him play an Atari game at a kiosk where other boys were taking turns. She went to shop around, and she never saw her son again.
Ugh.
In August, a severed head was found and was later confirmed to be that of Adam Walsh. The rest of his remains, to my knowledge, have never been found. It's believed that Otis Toole murdered Adam. There is some debate, as he confessed and then recanted, and then he died of some health complication in the mid-90s. I intend to cover his case in detail in the future, but in this context, I think it's important to know that John Walsh was a known figure at this point.
Right.
Because of, again, his own tragedy and how he really dove into this kind of crime aspect and getting word out there and enlisting the help of people. And at this time, America's Most Wanted had quite the viewership. The episode aired in May of 1989, and it had 10 minutes of airtime and reached an estimated 22 million viewers.
Holy cow.
In this episode, they showed a bust of what they thought John List would look like aged 18 years.
Wow.
And when I tell you this was accurate, I mean it was spot on accurate. When this episode comes out, one of the photos that will be included will be a side-by-side of John List at that age and the bust that they made of him. I mean, down to the glasses, the man didn't change his glasses.
I mean, that tracks.
Why would you? Anyway. I mean, come on.
I know.
Regardless, I know. Though. Calls began pouring in, between 250 and 300 calls, which sounds low to me considering how many people were watching, but you got to think, we're talking the 80s. Phones are different. It's different.
But also you think like, okay, how many people do you really interact with on a day to week to month basis, right? Like in your community, 250 to 300 calls could be his entire neighborhood calling in.
It could be. But like you can imagine, many of them are people prank calling.
Yeah.
Thinking it's a joke and trying to be a pain in the ass. Another group of those callers are just lonely people who know someone's going to pick up on the other end.
Yeah.
And then there's the group of callers who have valid information, who believe that their input is true and of value. And then that's where our girl Wanda comes back in.
Wanda!
Tell me you didn't forget about her.
As if I could. I love her.
Wanda okay. and her vision.
She be calling in.
Wanda did the Leonardo DiCaprio snap point at the TV and was like, God damn it, that's Bob Clark. She's like, I know
glasses
him.
Glasses and everything.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And you know that.
Oh, yeah.
Point. I'm talking about the, you know, I know him. Entirely my interpretation, I'm guessing. But she did watch it. You know she was an America's Most Wanted viewer. Like, you know she sat. I just imagine her chain smoking. Like, I could have solved it.
She said, I've been new. Thank you for catching up.
I would hate it if she didn't smoke, because it's how I picture her so much. But anyway, she had her son-in-law call into the show. Maybe okay, she wasn't tech savvy or didn't want to, but she's like, I need them to know, and I need your help to let them know.
Yeah.
So she did. And she told them Bob's new address in Virginia, because she had it, because Dolores gave her their new address, like, for mail or something like that. So she literally had the fucking coordinates for where the man they're looking for is.
Wanda, the way I would kiss your bunny slippered feet. Oh my gosh. Well, I love her.
Something else that's kind of funny is that John List was an avid watcher of America's Most Wanted.
Of course he is.
According to some sources, some say he wasn't and he never saw this episode, but others say he did, and that he saw himself on the TV. And it was almost like, when it's described, if you believe the sources that say he watched it, was that he didn't get, like, he didn't freak out or anything. He was like, it was about time.
Yeah. Well, because he's lived 17, 18 years, not for nothing. I have never and will never, and hope to God I'm never involved with anything that would end up on a true crime show, besides our podcast where we host it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, if it was me in that position, you bet your ass I'm watching true crime shit. Are you on to me or not?
I just imagine him with, like, a TV dinner on one of those trays.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and it's the Hungry Man meatloaf.
Always.
Yeah.
And he's still in his suit.
Yeah.
And it's like 7 p.m. and he goes, gosh darn it. And that's it. And then he's off to bed.
Well.
At a brisk 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's interesting because you also said he never really expected to get away with it. So he's had 18 years of borrowed time.
And he did. He felt like he was on borrowed time because he anticipated, like, the first week or so, like, he was going to get swatted.
Yeah.
And then that week passed and he's like, where the fuck are the, my words.
Yeah.
Where the fuck are all of
what the fuck? The, yeah.
Yeah. Where are the people? And nobody. And then more weeks passed and still nobody. And he's like, I just might.
Yeah.
Get some time. And he relaxed a little bit. And then some time turned into a lot of time. And it was 18 years.
It's a lot of Christmases.
But it's about to wrap up because in 2 weeks, on June 1st, 1989, the FBI arrived at the home John shared with Dolores.
Yay.
So Wanda said, here's that address. Do you need the zip code too? Or what do you need?
Baby.
While we are on the edge of our seats, you have to remember that tips came in for cases all of the time, and the majority of them yield nothing.
Right.
These agents didn't approach the home with high hopes. They knocked on the door and expected what usually happened. A lukewarm conversation, a handshake, and back on the road. After all, America's Most Wanted called the FBI and said that a woman, our girl Wanda, called in believing he was her former neighbor. And he has since moved, and here's his forwarding address, last I heard.
Right.
Sounds kind of like...
could go either way.
10 times removed.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, we'll give it a college try, but we're not hanging our hats on this. They knocked on the door, and Dolores answered, and agents explained why they were there.
Mm-hmm.
They asked for a few moments of her time, to which she obliged, but assured them that her husband, Bob, was of the highest caliber, and they've got the wrong guy.
Okay.
They asked if she had any photos of the two of them that they could see. Just, I mean, you got to think, we're not talking Facebook time here.
Right.
They don't know what the guy looks like. They have the estimated bust. That is not, that's not confirmation.
Right.
So, like, do you have a photo of you and your husband by any chance? And she says yes. And she gave them two, one of which was their wedding photo. And it was this photo that made them perk up.
Mm.
In the investigative podcast, Father Wants Us Dead, they interviewed one of the agents who said that the wedding photo looked like it had been the photo used in his wanted poster. That's how spot on it was.
Oh my gosh.
And if you haven't listened to Father Wants Us Dead, I believe they only have the one season and it's on this case. I enjoyed it. I really liked the conversations that they had with other people and their input, especially because it's from so long ago. I think you're going to start losing a lot of that.
Right.
And so much of this wasn't exactly, like, Googleable, you know what I mean? So very fascinating. The bust shown on America's Most Wanted was strikingly similar, even depicting the scar behind his right ear.
Wow.
Which was a scar that Wanda had noted in her report.
Wow.
And then they see that same exact scar in the photo that Dolores had just shown them.
Okay.
These agents, they didn't want Dolores to know, so they played it cool. Like they were doing a routine follow-up and they'll be out of her hair. But they did have a few more questions. You know, gotta dot the I's, cross the T's. They said it didn't look like their guy, but in an effort to be thorough, they just wanted to swing by his workplace and chat with him a few minutes so they could clear him.
Right.
One agent stayed behind with Dolores to make sure that she did not tip him off.
Okay.
While the other headed to John's work to get eyes on him. It became crystal clear to them that Dolores had no idea who Robert P. Clark was.
Oh.
She did not know the man that she married. So they're kind of pacifying her at this point, saying, it's not, but we gotta do our due diligence. Would you mind just jotting the address down?
Right.
And she does that, and I'm sure she offered the guy who stayed with her tea and whatever, and she's just casually talking. She's not worried at all. I think she's a little like, why are you here? Like, you're wasting your time. I feel sorry that this is how you're spending your day.
Like, aw, buddy, here's a coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. But while one's hanging out with her, just, I'm assuming, shooting the shit, the other one is like, oh my God, 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 running out. So, like, you have, like, this stark contrast of what these two men are doing.
Right. Well, and it's obviously once you're there for a little bit, I'm sure that picture becomes a lot clearer. But for anybody who's curious, obviously, like, you don't want to tip her off in case she's in on it. And in case she's like, babe, get the fuck out of Dodge.
And that's just it. So they stayed, one of them stayed there so that she wouldn't call him and say, you need to run. Because this is the closest they've ever been. The closest they have ever been. They cannot risk.
And I just have to say, like, I'm so impressed always when people do this. Like, investigators, you have to have quite the fucking poker face. Because if I was sitting there, oh, the way my leg would be shaking, I'd be like, oh my God. Like, I'd be anxiously anticipating what happens next.
Oh, I could do it, though.
The way, yeah, just kick back, be like, yeah, so how's your day? How are the kids?
Because, yeah, you can't tip her off. Yeah. You have to be, like, you know, I'd ask her about things she got around the house. Oh, what's that? Any books you've read lately? My wife, my God, she has been reading this one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like,
oh, I can yap. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, we have a yapetite. I don't know if you guys knew that.
We sure do. But I just think that's so interesting.
It absolutely is. So that agent, on his way to visit Mr. Clark, quickly found a payphone to call in backup.
Yeah, he could did.
Not, he yeah, could not he do did. This alone. He and others arrived at the office and were speaking with the receptionist when none other than John List himself cluelessly walks down the hallway, papers in hand, like it's another average day at work.
That's so funny.
Well, because up until this point, it was. John was compliant.
Yeah.
He spoke with them. He didn't panic. He didn't try to run. One of the investigators said in an interview with, again, this Father Wants Us Dead podcast, that John wasn't animated despite the circumstances.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating because you would expect if anything would get a reaction out of him, if the murder of his family didn't, maybe being caught for it would have. And it didn't. That he was just sort of an odd man and he seemed to be a vessel without a soul. Like he was empty. He even said, quote, if you looked into his eyes, there was nothing there.
Yeah, he's an NPC. He's a non-player character.
Yeah, well, it also just seems like, to me, like I describe those as shark eyes. Like there is nothing behind them. Like there's a blackness to them that there is a distant layer.
Yeah. There.
Like there's space between you and that person and it's not physical. It's very odd and very eerie.
That's so interesting. I wonder if he was like, can I shred these papers? They've got like personally identifiable information on them.
Right?
Like, or if, no. Yeah.
No? Okay. He surrendered very easily, but he still denied everything. He's like, I'm Robert Clark. I will go with you. I will chat with you. I will answer any questions.
That's interesting.
But I am not John List. I don't know. Who is this John List you speak of, right?
Oh, is that like a new restaurant? Or
how could I be John List if I'm Robert Peter Clark?
Right.
After he was searched and cuffed, they confirmed his hernia scars on his midsection, which matched medical records they had of him. Also, the scar behind his ear, which just validated that, yes, they do have the right guy. But I regret to inform you that there is no chase or battle of the century. He didn't fight, he didn't freak, he didn't react. He assured them he wasn't John, that he was Robert, and he maintained this story as he was placed in the cruiser.
I expect nothing less.
John's fingerprints were on record from a handgun permit that he'd like requested years and years ago. And I believe a permit he never even picked up.
Okay.
But these fingerprints just happened to exactly match the man who had for nearly 20 years been known as, you guessed it, Bob Clark.
That's so interesting because he's not John List, he's Bob Clark.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Meanwhile, investigators in Virginia contacted those in Westfield, New Jersey to share the good news.
Hey.
Can you imagine getting that phone call?
Oh, best day.
And one of the investigators, he'd been working the case since the beginning. He called the retired police chief of Westfield, the man who reluctantly ended his career without having caught the notorious John List,
mm-hmm.
and had to let him know.
Nice.
Like, your old boss who retired, you have to call and say, we got him. Like, they have him. This case stuck with the chief so deep, he carried the wanted poster in his shirt pocket at all times.
Aww.
In the last podcast on the left coverage of this case, Marcus says something that resonated, and he said something to the effect that, despite John's denial to authorities, Robert P. Clark didn't exist before 1971.
Right.
Which I think is just, I mean, obviously, but it's a very clear-cut way of saying, like, where one begins, the other ends.
Yeah.
And that is obviously true because it's the same person and there's really no other way to rationalize how that could happen.
Right.
And anyway, I didn't want to take credit for it, but it is very an interesting way that it was put that I just thought described it very well.
It's a good visual.
John maintained his story. And then Dolores affirmed it. She stood by her husband and was quickly ruled out as having anything to do with both the murders and concealing him. So, I mean, their entire marriage, they truly believed that she truly believed he was who he said.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty significant deal because she could be looking at some significant charges here.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she could be doing time for concealing him. But
Dolores said, that's mine. And I'm a stand beside him. And they said, that's not who you think that is. And she goes, no, that's mine.
Dolores didn't have it easy, though. Reporters were nearly stalking her. Ugh. She was thrust into the spotlight all at once. The wife of a murderer. A man who killed his own mother, his wife, and his three kids. The people he was supposed to love and protect. Imagine being her, waking up one morning. Your husband beside you. You make your coffee. You eat your breakfast. You read a book. There's a knock on the door, and in a matter of hours, your whole life is turned upside down.
Yeah.
I feel so much for her in those moments because I cannot imagine what it was like.
I couldn't imagine what it was like, and I am not the kind of person who marries someone so antisocial they don't want a pie from the neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not anything against her. Obviously, that's not her actions, but clearly she is, if not the same way, at least interested in a very quiet life that just got absolutely blown to pieces.
Yeah, and a man that you don't really know a whole lot about his past, and maybe you didn't care a whole lot about what it was because you were just content to
be.
I'm assuming she was married before. It's an assumption. But, you know, maybe they were like, all right, well, what we had before wasn't working, so let's give this a shot. What she didn't know is that John was just repeating the cycle that he had had that ended in the death of his other wife, but you know,
right?
But other than that, he's a catch. So okay,
but yeah, I do feel for her, and I do think it's at least obvious that up until this point she had no clue. I mean, just the sheer, I guess, self-assuredness in her nose to Wanda back when they lived near her.
Mm-hmm. She couldn't be convinced. She couldn't even really be tempted to consider.
Yeah. That. She stood by it.
Because she felt so much that she knew her husband, and this was her husband of years. Like, yeah. Right. The guy never leaves. What do you mean he's killing? Yeah, all right. He's killing people. You know what I mean?
She's like, sure. He can't even go out and crush an interview. He's not going to go crush people. Yeah.
Yeah. Just he's not my husband. No.
Okay.
Kind of the way. You know what I mean? But Dolores was nearly run off the road by reporters as she tried to dodge them. And she maintained that her husband was who he said, and not the infamous John List. But she didn't have anywhere to turn. Remember, they had only just moved to Richmond.
Right.
They'd been there for maybe a year, and she left her whole world behind out west. She didn't have friends there yet. She didn't have any family. What she did have, though, and what I think is really beautiful through all of this dark, is the community at their church.
Oh.
We've spent this entire series talking about the horrific acts of one man who claimed to be a man of God. And there were so many people who truly wanted to do and be good, who stepped up and shared small acts of kindness. And that made the true difference from the religious community.
I love that.
So you have this one man who says, I killed them for God to send them to heaven. Didn't you see how amazing I am? Who wasn't. And then you have all of these people that are actually like rallying around her to be there for her, to comfort her during this time, despite what her husband did.
Right. And I love that element of church communities. Like when they wrap around, they wrap around.
The home that Dolores had shared with John was buzzing with reporters, photographers, journalists, and they all wanted a word from her. She didn't want to go home. She might not have even felt safe. She might not have even felt like she could have gone home. And you have to wonder, would she have been? Would people have been outraged thinking that she concealed him? Would they want to physically harm her? Or would they just, try to peek through the blinds and stand outside her door and just be a nuisance? I mean, there's a kind of a range of what could have happened.
Right.
That she wasn't prepared to deal with.
Right.
Friends from church stepped up and let her stay with them.
That's very gracious.
They were there for her as she navigated the impossible, which I think probably did so much for her because she lost everything.
Yeah.
This case stirred up a lot, as you can imagine. The notion that you could be married to a man for decades, make a family and appear successful, and in one day and minutes, he could pull the trigger and end your life. The fear of not knowing who you're married to is a real one.
Mm-hmm.
And John List was proof of this fear. Dolores also didn't know the man she was married to, and it sent another shockwave because not only did Helen not know, but Dolores couldn't see it.
Right.
And this begs the question, was Dolores in danger? In my research, I've seen two prevailing theories. The first is that Dolores was not in danger, that it statistically is highly unlikely, but also that John had been so riddled with stress unlike he'd ever experienced before, stress he wasn't equipped to deal with, that he just lost it and calculated a way out. He didn't feel that with Dolores because they were relatively happy, so Dolores was safe.
Okay.
The other theory is that Dolores was next. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. John was repeating the same pattern, settling down, losing his well-paying job, having to search and settle for lesser-paying jobs. He relied on her money to fund his startup business and needed her money to float them when he couldn't support her. Resentment grew. What if it bubbled up again? Would Dolores have been safe? Had he learned? Or would he just want to start fresh again?
Right.
That other podcast I mentioned, Father Wants Us Dead, they uncovered information I didn't see anywhere else. And I think that's just because they sat with the people who investigated the case and heard it all firsthand, and these weren't recorded anywhere.
Right. So
take this information with that I didn't see this elsewhere, but I also trust in the people saying it.
Right, yeah.
That I'm entertaining it.
Firsthand accounts from investigators get some weight from me.
I want to give that disclaimer because in one of their episodes, they talked about this conversation that we're about to get to. And this is a crossroads point in this case, and it can change the way that we consider John List's motives. They said that there's a report of an officer being in the room when Dolores and John spoke 2 days after his arrest.
Okay.
So he's detained. There's someone else present, but they're able to speak. Think window, phone on the hook, hand pressed against the glass.
Right.
It's reported that John admitted to Dolores that he was John List. And that what they were saying, all these reports about him, were true.
Okay.
He told her of Helen's drinking and substance use, that they were in debt and drowning, that he couldn't take it, and he did it. And also, if this is true, it's also said that there's no mention of religious influence.
Hmm.
No attempt at saving them from themselves and sending them to God, letting them die Christians and all that. No mention of preserving their souls, as he will later say and as he wrote in his confession letter to his pastor. But this changes the game, doesn't it? It's as if he's admitting the rest is bullshit because his true intention was to just be rid of them.
Right.
Now, this is one person's account, and it's an account of an account, so it's like, I heard from the guy that was in this room.
Right.
That this happened.
Who heard him say this?
I feel like, I don't know if those conversations would have been privileged, or why this guy didn't testify, or if he did, why I couldn't find anything about it. And I think that this is very possible. I don't think anybody's intentionally lying here, but I also think that that's the conclusion I arrived at before I heard that conversation.
And that just feels like extra weight in that basket.
Yeah, I didn't think this was for the reasons he claims it is, and we'll talk about a lot of that in just a little bit, but to me that kind of lays out exactly what a lot of us, I think, were already thinking. He did also, apparently, during this conversation, encourage Dolores to sell the story and try to make money off her situation.
Oh, okay.
And if that's true, this blows the lid off his whole defense. Like, make a profit, I'm gonna roll with this. But, like, if all of these things from this supposed conversation are true, well...
Brother.
It just changes everything.
And, you know, it just really, it raises once again for me the question of, where are the brain cells? Do we remember that everything you say on a phone, in a room, around the perimeter of a police station is probably fucking recorded? Not to mention, if it's on the phone, they directly tell you it's recorded.
Well, you say that, but we're talking 1989. Is it recorded?
Well, we got Walkmans at least.
Yeah, we do. But are they... Data storage is so expensive at that time. Are they recording that? Could they? Was that considered privileged? Who else was there?
But even so, if someone else in the room...
Yeah, okay. But if his attorneys were there, then now it's privileged. I mean, that officer shouldn't have been listening. You know what I mean? Like, I have a lot of questions about the circumstances around that, where, like, I think it's very possible, even likely, but I don't know that I buy it.
Yeah.
100%. Like, I'm not fully hanging my hat on it.
Oh, I'm not. It's just one of those themes that you see so often of people confessing or saying things like this, or, you know, you get booked and your first call is to your girlfriend. It's like, babe, hide my stuff.
Exactly.
Right after they tell you. And it's like, okay. All right. Like, I know that you have gotten away with it for 18 years. I know that you want to talk to your wife and tell her things that you probably wish were behind closed doors. But you kind of gave up that right when you murdered your family.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone was listening in, that's how it is. If it is recorded, that's because you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Just my personal rant.
And I love it.
Oh, babe.
His defense had a lot of tricks up their sleeves.
I'm sure.
One thing I hear in true crime podcasts all too often is damning the defense team. And I think everyone can be guilty of it because we have such visceral reactions to some of these cases. And rightfully so, it's human. It can be frustrating and you might have very strong words and opinions on the matter. But the defense's job is to loyally and effectively provide the best defense possible for their client.
Right.
It isn't about preservation of the victim's reputation. It isn't about fairness to others. It is about their client. It's one of the reasons why I think I would struggle to be a defense attorney. Because I know I would struggle defending somebody like John List and trying to use unsavory details about his victims as justification of his actions is not an approach I would sleep well taking, but it happens. But if you were a defendant, and I hope you never are, then you will want the best defense team possible.
Yeah.
And if you work in the criminal justice field, you have to put your personal thoughts and your bias aside. You may not like everyone you work with, whether you are a prosecutor, a defense attorney, corrections officer, victim advocate, police officer, and every single road in between. But you treat them all as human, you treat them with respect, because it's likely not your place to determine their punishment, and it doesn't matter if you agree with their actions or you don't.
Right.
And that can be extremely challenging. That is why you need to leave your personal life at the door, along with your personal opinions and your bias, because there is a job to do. And if it's a job you can't do, you shouldn't. And that's okay too. Step back when you need to, run something by your boss or another professional, because the work you do isn't easy, but it is very important. You cannot only do your job if you like the person or you dislike the person. And I want to get that out of the way because John's defense hits hard.
Ugh.
And personally, I don't like it either. But it is a fact. You don't have to personally agree with it. It's just what happens. And you'd want the same thing too.
Right. And I think, you know, again, everybody is a human. Everybody who is at least going through this system has the right to this defense.
Yeah, it's a necessary piece of our criminal justice system. But personally, if I were to be on either side, I'd be a prosecutor.
Oh, I'd love to be a judge. I'd hate to be either attorney. But it is one of those that very much so, if you can't put that aside, if you can't recognize your own feelings, your biases, because we all have implicit biases, like you have to step outside of that and really step into sort of that black and white structure of what are you afforded and what is the law, what is on the books, what isn't, and how do we come to terms with what you have done and what that makes you culpable of.
Mm-hmm. His defense's first approach was trying to get as much as they could determined inadmissible.
Right.
The main piece of evidence they fought to get thrown out was the letter John left for the pastor.
All right.
That letter we read, and I believe part two, about why he did it. They were veering away from Christianity. If any of these things had been, you know, the only thing, I wouldn't have killed them. But because of all of these circumstances, I had to. I trust they're in heaven. I'll join them again one day. Please forgive me.
Yeah.
XOXO, by the way, mom's upstairs in the third floor. She was too fucking fat to move. I hate that so much, the way he did that.
Oh.
Horrible. But that letter is a huge piece of this.
Right.
Their approach to trying to get this letter thrown out was utilizing essentially what they would call privileged communication between a member of clergy and someone like repenting. So I looked at, I think it's Justia, I don't know how you say it, but we've all seen it if you've looked up these cases, U.S. law for New Jersey. And it's, this law is listed under cleric penitent privilege.
Is it that's classified info?
Try saying that 10 times fast, though. It's ridiculous. But anyway, this is how they list it. Any communication made in confidence to a cleric and the cleric's professional character or as a spiritual advisor in the course of the discipline or practice of the religious body to which the cleric belongs or of the religion which the cleric professes shall be privileged. Privileged communications shall include confessions and other communications made in confidence between and among the cleric and individuals, couples, families, or groups in the exercise of the cleric's professional or spiritual counseling role.
Okay.
Meaning, essentially, that the conversation between a clergy member, such as a pastor, are privileged. Think similar to the way a conversation between a client and attorney are.
Right.
And I'm sure you're thinking, damn, Allie, are there not any fucking exceptions? To which I say, yes, no, there are.
Good.
The privilege accorded to communications under this rule shall belong to both the cleric and the person or persons making the communication and shall be subject to waiver only under the following circumstances.
Okay.
One, both the person or persons making the communication and the cleric consent to the waiver of this privilege.
Sure.
Or the privilege communication pertains to a future criminal act, in which case the cleric alone may but is not required to waive the privilege.
Okay.
So if both of you say it's okay for that conversation to be leaked, you can. And if the, let's say the pastor knows of a crime someone intends to commit
but has not yet committed,
but has not yet done so, they can but do not have to say something.
Right. So if you're my pastor and I say, I'm going to kill my wife, you can tell someone. But if I come to you and I say, I killed my wife, you cannot.
Correct.
Yeah.
under the circumstance of like, this is my confession. Like, right. I'm receiving counseling, spiritual guidance from you.
Right. You can't just like walk up to a random person and expect them to not have any.
Correct. John's defense team cited this as the reason the letter shouldn't be admissible because it fell under that clause of protected communication.
Okay.
Prosecution pushed back, arguing that the letter was left abandoned in the home along with the rest of his possessions. And at that point, that's no longer privileged.
Right.
The judge ultimately sided with prosecution, saying that the letter was left in the mansion like everything else, like the rest of his belongings. And if it were meant to be read by the pastor and the pastor alone, he would have seen to it that the letter be sent directly to the pastor and not just in the home for anybody to find.
That's fair. That is always a fun part of law, is figuring out what exactly all that means.
Oh, yeah.
What value.
Yeah. And poring over it. And I'm sure that part of your law textbook isn't like a page that you've got marked because you're using it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
His defense would ultimately, though, try to use his religious beliefs to say that he snapped, that this all stemmed from his OCD, his obsessive compulsive disorder, and that he wasn't equipped with the skills to handle what he was feeling, and he just couldn't take it. That he thought by killing his family before they were too far gone, before they sinned too much, before they were consumed with evil, before they could destroy themselves, he instead sent them to heaven. Defense painted the scene as one that John saw no other way out, that he saw his wife deteriorate and his children stray and act out. I mean, his daughter was even leaving the church.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't protect them anymore, mm-hmm. and this was the best way he knew how.
Mm-hmm.
John even said later that he could have just killed his wife, but then the kids would have to be raised by his mom, who was elderly, and she didn't know it yet, but penniless, you know, because he had been bleeding her accounts. His children would end up in poverty, which, you know, not good, and what he was trying to avoid.
Right, because if they take any form of public assistance, it's admitting failure.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And he felt that, you know, his mom was too old and it would be too much for her to care for all three kids. And he could have just killed his wife and the kids and let his mom live. But then the devastation of losing her grandchildren would be torture for her. So then she's better off dead. So really, it just made sense to kill them all so that, you know, everybody's
sure.
happy.
Well, and like when I buy sandals, it's really hard to pick brown or black, because what if my outfits that are like a dark brown aren't happy that they have to go with black sandals? So I just get both because it's for them.
See, I'm the brand of mentally ill where if I pick up like the brown pair and the black pair and say like I want to go with the brown one, I will feel so bad for the black pair, mm-hmm. personally, like I don't want to hurt its feelings.
Right.
That I will spend my money to get both of them.
Yeah.
Because that's how weird I am. So I don't know. Regardless though, really stretching for these reaches.
Truly.
In his mind, as they put it, killing them all was something for which he could ask for forgiveness. So to be clear, the position is, in his mind, it was better to murder his family brutally and run than admit to their financial situation, purchase a lesser home, get any kind of help, communicate with anybody,
mm-hmm.
continuously seek a better paying job, you know, like working hard and shit.
Mm-hmm.
He believed if he murdered them, he would have time to earn God's forgiveness. And he had every intent of being reunited with them one day in heaven. So it really wasn't goodbye. It was
TTFN.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ta-ta for now.
So interesting. And you know, that is the classic saying. It's better to ask for forgiveness than to get a job, talk to your wife, and not kill your entire family. And that's just what they say.
You know, they do say that. They do. I've heard that. And they do. Prosecution had other thoughts.
Yeah.
I tend to fall in this camp. They cited the meticulous planning as evidence that he did not just snap. That he carefully planned his family's deaths. That he maximized the amount of time between their murders and the discovery of their bodies by contacting their schools, canceling deliveries, leaving lights on, leaving music playing, lowering the heat to preserve the bodies. All of this proved that this was far more than just a man who snapped.
Right.
It was a man who saw a way to dispose of his family and all of their disappointments and start fresh and move on. And that's what he did. He discarded them for his own pleasure. And here is where I differ from many on this.
Mm-hmm.
Most believe he killed them due to religious delusion, that he should still serve the time and that he planned it and that he was meticulous, that he didn't just snap, but the root of it was his faith leading him in that direction. And I think that that could be true, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
To me, he didn't kill them because of the delusion. He wanted to kill them and then went to the only place he looked to for guidance. And then he crossed wires and split hairs and made up his own justification and jumped around on one foot three times and really stretched for that reach to justify this in his mind. I think he wanted to be rid of them, but he couldn't do it without first making it quote unquote just in his mind. And he had to really squint so much that his eyes were closed to be able to find a way to loosely justify this in his mind.
Right.
He wanted them dead first. He found the justification after, to me. He figured he could kill them, beg forgiveness, and he'd be forgiven. But if he were doing this for righteous reasons, to spare them from evil and hell, as twisted as this sounds, he could have also killed them, as he did, but then turned himself in.
Right.
He could have said, here I am, here's what I did, and here's why. And then he could have earned that forgiveness that he was seeking within prison walls. There's church in prison, John. But he didn't, because it wasn't about the religion, I don't think. It wasn't about saving them. It was about washing his hands of them, letting the debt and the shame, humiliation and frustration, and the rage die with them too.
Right.
John knew if he left them, if he packed up his dress shirts and his ties, he packed his little Preparation H and his little sunglasses case, that he'd still be on the hook for the money owed on the house, for child support, for his mom. But if he disappeared, and if they did, who would know?
Yeah.
If he could wash his hands of them entirely and relocate and sink into the background of wherever he ended up, wasn't that the best case scenario for him?
Well, and I tend to fall in this camp for different reasons, but I still end up in the same place, which is that everything he has said is contradictory. And mm-hmm. also, it feels like a really shitty excuse to use OCD.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is a personal bias. I am an OCD girly. You can read my charts. I am clinically such. But like, OCD, as it's presented as a stereotype, is very monk, right? I have mm-hmm. I have to touch every light bulb as I go by. I have to count my steps. I have to wash my hands 100 times a day. There's this notion that it's almost exclusively like germaphobes
mm-hmm.
And sort of obsessions over things that are slight risks, but generally not risks.
Mm-hmm.
And then compulsively responding to that to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But OCD is about all sorts of things. There are people who like Maria Bamford, for mm-hmm. one, is a comedian with like crippling OCD who
hilarious,
every time,
by the way,
hysterical, but every time she saw a knife would freak out that she was going to kill her family. She didn't want to kill her family.
Mm-hmm.
So her response to that was not, let me do the thing I'm afraid of happening. It was, I can't cut things up. I can't be in the kitchen. I can't look at knives. And like that impairs your life for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a very interesting thing, because even if you did have obsessions over, is my family going to heaven? Are they going to be okay? Are they going to find favor within God? His justification for not killing himself, essentially, after this, was that I will have time to make it up to God.
Like, I am redeemable.
Right.
But they're not.
And also, if what you need to be redeemable to God after committing multiple homicides, which is in the Ten Commandments, by the way, not dressing up for Halloween is not something that the Ten Commandments says you cannot do, but murder is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying I'm redeemable with enough time. They're not. So I can't let them live. And then I won't take accountability, which is the only way that you can get forgiveness in the church, is if you ask for it. And I find it very frustrating that that becomes the premise of his acquittal or lesser guilt, because he did do all of that to prep. He did do all of those things. And
yeah, it wasn't like, you can call, was he a very religious man? Yeah. And then
yeah.
When he wanted to do something really bad that he knew was wrong, that morally contradicted mm-hmm. the way in which he was raised, he had to, stretch every aspect of what he believed to try to mold it into something that allowed him to do that. And then when it really didn't fit, he was just like, it's just what I thought.
Right.
That's just how I rationalized it. You know what I mean? It was like, he was a religious man in a way for a lot of his life, but he wanted to do evil, and then he needed to find a way to rectify that.
Right.
And so he used the only thing that, like, the only moral code that he had ever run things by before.
Cognitive dissonance is a hell of a drug.
And it was. The jury, though.
Mm-hmm.
They're girls, girls. They're one of us.
Yes, girlies.
I have no idea
GN.
If there were even any women on this jury. But anyway, they did what we wanted them to do.
Love.
They found him guilty on 5 counts of first-degree murder on April 12th, 1990.
Good.
On May 1st, he was sentenced, and he received 5 consecutive life sentences.
Wow.
According to an article in My Central Jersey, the jury hit a speed bump in their deliberation when it came time to determine the degree. And one of the jurors was just quoted as saying the biggest thing was trying to define the degree of guilt. So first, second, you know what I mean?
Like, right.
Where are we finding this? How premeditated was this? Where, yeah. How much weight do you give the delusion? That kind of thing. Another juror, Joseph Hobbs, said, quote, and I include this quote because it, of course it matters, but I think it's funny the way that it's written because it's kind of like, no shit. But he said, I don't think we were swayed too much until we sat down with the physical evidence. The presentations of both sides were very impressive, but when it came down to it, the evidence is what did it. Which is like, that's a lot of ways to say the thing that you're tasked with doing is like looking at the evidence. But I think what it came down to was, you can hear all of these stories about delusion and all, like, you can hear
right
what they're saying about it, but the proof is in the bodies being lined up,
the timelines,
luring them home,
yeah,
canceling the orders, telling school you're gonna be away, letting work let it know that they're gonna be away, like the method used of like systematically executing each family right. member. Like, I think that's what he meant, but I just thought of all of the quotes to take from the guy. This article put that, and it made me laugh a little bit.
Well, listen, when we looked at the evidence, we thought this is really interesting, but at the end of the day, it's the evidence that we looked at.
But like, defense probably had a lot of shit that they threw at the wall and just hoped something would stick, and nothing stuck enough like the physical evidence that prosecution had.
Right.
And so it's good that they were able to see through a lot of that. And when they were just poring over the actual pages of everything.
Right.
To say, okay, well, this is what he did. And then he just went and lived like normal.
Which also is contradictory to any indication that it's like essentially an obsession, or obsession in like an OCD sort of term, because mm-hmm. that wouldn't end.
Mm-mm.
Those don't just go, man, I wish that shit just went away if you did the fucking thing. Mm-hmm. They don't. That's not how it works.
Newsflash.
And also, like,
heard from a friend, it doesn't go away.
Yeah. No, even if you do wash your hands 100 times a day, Mr. Monk the detective still does it the next day. He's not cured.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of damning in that sense. But also, when we think of the word snapped, sure, we can say like all of these different stressful situations led up to a moment in time, or like a few months or a period of time where he was more stressed and would consider doing something he wouldn't otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't something happened, he blinked his eyes, and then all of his family members were dead. Even the killings themselves were over an entire day.
to me, though, a, like, snapping, I would have believed that, you know, Helen in her state, because she was unwell, I mean, she wasn't behaving like herself. We'd spent most of episode one really talking about her condition as it had gotten worse as she entered later stages of syphilis. And physically, her body, she was bedbound a lot. She wasn't able to do much. She was struggling. I mean, the woman was in pain.
Right.
And mentally, she wasn't herself. And she challenged him, and she made digs at him, and she emasculated him in his mind. And snapping would have been her making a comment at him, or maybe like throwing water at him or something, and he pushes her, she falls back, hits her head, and because she was already weak,
right,
that's what killed her. That to me is snapping.
Right.
Or snapping and strangling her. Snapping, you know what I mean? But like, that to me is a singular
one act, one instance
where this isn't this prolonged thought out day where like he had hours between killing his wife and Helen mm-hmm. and when Patty got home.
And that's just the killings. That's none of the preparation work. Mm-hmm.
And the preparation had started that morning.
Right.
So we're, I mean, yeah, it's a day. A lot can happen in a day, but a lot happened that day. A lot of planning went on in his mind before that day.
Enough that he had conversations with his kids about what they wanted when they died.
Oh, and then it didn't even happen.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, what a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
So, anyway, knowing what we know about John List, as you've just spent several hours with us over the course of the series, I have some questions for you, dear listener.
Mm.
What do you think? Do you think John's motivation was rooted in his faith? Or was his motivation rooted in his own selfish desire and he used his faith?
Something in between?
Second, do you feel Dolores was ever in danger? And third, what did you learn?
Mm.
Did this prompt you to take communicating with those around you more seriously? Does it prompt you to be hyper aware of your neighbors? Does it prompt you to want to watch America's Most Wanted and look mm-hmm. at your neighbors a little funny? I don't know. When asked if he would do it all again, John List said he would not.
Okay.
At the age of 82, John List died of complications of pneumonia on March 21st, 2008.
Okay.
He had 18 years of freedom post-murders and 18 years of prison post-conviction.
Wow.
John List and his case served as the inspiration for a lot of media. He was the basis of the antagonist in the movie The Usual Suspects in 1995. He was the inspiration of the Law and Order episode titled Savior in season 6. There was a movie based on his life called Judgment Day, the John List story, in which Robert Blake plays him. His case has been covered by many podcasts and crime shows and so much more. But ultimately, Helen, her children, Patty, John, Frederick, and Alma deserved better. Helen, despite her behavior, I guess, toward the end, was his wife and was a good mom and tried her best until she really couldn't anymore.
And a disease took over. And it wasn't her.
Her daughter, Brenda, the older, remember when they got together, she had like a 9-year-old.
Right.
So by the time they got married and started having kids, Brenda was like in her later teens. And like as soon as she was of age to move out, and like she did, she got married, she did everything. Right. So she lost everyone. She lost her half-siblings. She lost her mom.
Right.
Her dad already died.
Yeah.
So she lost everything that day. And John was like an okay stepdad. She didn't have any complaints about him.
Right.
Until the obvious. But it wasn't like he was this terrible stepdad. Like, he took her on as his own.
Right.
But he wasn't like, I don't really think he was like giving hugs. I don't know.
Yeah.
Alma, his mom, probably looked forward to living with her only son, spending time with him and the kids. And I believe it was in her diaries or other family that noted that the years that she spent living in that mansion were the worst of her life.
Ugh.
They were the saddest, most down years that she ever had. His kids were denied any opportunity to grow up, to become who they were going to be, whether they were going to become what John wanted them to be or not. If you have kids because you want them to be exactly who you want them to be, don't have kids.
Yeah.
They are their own people. But he denied them any opportunity that he gave himself, which was to be forgiven.
Right.
If that is what he believed, which, I mean, I don't know. But their lives were stolen by their dad.
Yeah.
John fought his dad as he tried to kill him.
Yeah.
His middle child, the oldest son, his namesake.
Right.
Was the one that put up the fight. He was the only one that had enough time to see what was happening to react. Patty didn't see it at all. She was shot in the back of the head.
Right.
There are photos that I did not share because they are gruesome.
Yeah.
That are horrifying. The way that their faces are frozen in horror. It is so upsetting. So while it, yeah, okay, we didn't spend a whole lot of time like on the murders themselves, because there isn't a whole lot to the murders themselves. They were a matter of minutes. But they are murders nonetheless.
Yeah.
And gruesome and gnarly, and what he did and how they left, how he left them, and just, it, you don't have words for it. Like, that's,
oh, I have lots of feelings on this.
Well, I want to hear our listeners' feelings, because that is all that I have for you today.
Yeah. Are you guys in the same boat as me? Because I came into this knowing very little about John List, like the general overview, and learned a lot. I feel for Dolores. I obviously, like, my heart breaks for his family when I think about my dad. There is nobody in this world I feel safer with.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have that in life or in his participation in ending their lives.
Absolutely. And they thought he was going to do it anyway. Like, Patty went to her drama teacher. Patty went to a trusted adult, which we're all told to do.
Right.
And that trusted adult may or may not have failed her. I don't know whether he didn't buy it or she only said it once and it was kind of in passing and he thought she was kidding. I don't know.
Right.
I think it's better to be safe than sorry, but we're talking about a different time.
Right. And a teacher that she was oddly close with. So there's a lot there.
Who didn't exactly want to maybe give details to police as to why this 16-year-old felt so comfortable talking to him and only him.
Right.
You know, maybe it was to save his own ass. He could be a total asshole. I don't know.
Right.
But we're talking about 50 years ago that I won't pretend to know.
Right.
You know, what it was like societally, late 60s, early 70s. So, I mean, I don't know what you did and didn't, you know.
Right. And maybe
say something about.
Maybe he was just a teacher she really connected with and felt safe telling, but regardless, that never got passed on for whatever the reason was. And she was terrified. She told her friends. Her siblings had to sit with her as teens and under to talk about what they wanted when they died with the person who brought them into this world.
As if he was going to be around to be the one to ensure that it happened. And then I'm pretty sure they were cremated, even though they said buried. I could be wrong.
Right.
But I am pretty sure. And also, who the fuck was paying for that?
But it wasn't him.
That's what I'm saying. It was like, do you just leave their last wishes and then, like, expect somebody to know what that was? What are you talking about?
PPS, they want to be buried. Hope you can afford it. XOXO, Gossip Girl. Like,
PPS, mom's on the third floor. Couldn't bring her down.
What a dick.
I hate that. What an insult to your mom. She was not perfect, but goddamn.
Also, not for nothing. You're going down the you're not even going upstairs. Gravity's on your side, brother. Like,
I imagine him trying, and then he was like,
Sorry, I know it's not appropriate to say grow up about whatever. Grow up. Also, as far as the Dolores question, I don't know. I think there is an element that anybody around him would be technically in danger because, well, we know he's capable of this.
He is, but then if you consider, right? So if he's your neighbor.
Right.
He's probably the best neighbor that you could
oh,
have.
Oh, for sure.
He's not going to like the music you listen to.
Well, yeah. But he's not going to tell you about it.
But he's also not going to be like knocking on your door and be like, do you have a moment to spend about Jesus Christ?
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, overstep, maybe like you tried that once and I say no. He's not going to be there like every Sunday, like just checking in. You want to go to church with me? Like, he's not like an up your ass neighbor. He's not blasting his own music. If he is, it's classical. It's not exactly like super heavy with the bass.
Right.
Probably not going to hear it. He wasn't the kind of guy that if you flipped him off in traffic, he was going to get out of his car with a baseball bat and try to like fuck up your headlights.
Right.
Like he didn't have an angry, well, I can't say he wasn't angry. He didn't have a reactive piece of him.
Right.
Until that day. Now, with the preparation and everything, consider that what you will. But I mean, at max a month or two of planning, thinking, conceptualizing, justifying, you know, I'm buying him time.
Right.
And he was unemployed, so he had 40 extra hours a week than, you know, he had had previously. So, you know, realistically, right? Like, there were efforts made leading up to that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Then there was the day that it happened. And then after that, he never did that again. Like, you just have to think, were other people in danger? Or was that really a man who was at his wit's end, didn't see a way out, and wanted to be free of them? Like, wanted to cut all ties permanently?
Yeah. For me, I guess the danger isn't really the question. Is it imminent? I think anybody who's capable of that is dangerous to be around.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we learned, or what I learned from his first go round, is that he will eat it until he can't. He will never tell you when he's eating it, so you don't know what's bothering him or how full that tank is getting until it busts.
Mm-hmm.
And when it overflows, then it's done. And while I can appreciate a long fuse, that bomb was never disarmed. It was just going until it lit.
Right.
And so I think that anybody that he was around, it might have taken longer because there was only one person to cause him stress instead of five others.
Mm-hmm.
It might have never amounted until he was gone even. But if you're capable of that once, and especially with the people that he was capable of doing it to, I don't think anybody is in a protected status around him. I don't think he was going to snap anytime soon, because he was getting to live off of someone else's money even when he didn't have a job and things were pretty calm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like he couldn't take stress. He just couldn't take all of the stress he had at that time.
But when somebody lets stress, let's say, eat at them and eat mm-hmm. at them and eat at them, as awful as that is, and as suffocating and as frustrating, and maybe it makes you rageful or maybe it makes you shut down. We're all different. We're all wired different. You might not even get to have control over your stressors.
Right.
But you do control, and it is your responsibility to do something about the stress that you feel.
Yeah.
Get help for processing that stress. And that's a hard truth that a lot of people don't want to accept. And that's not to say that there aren't barriers to that and that there aren't exigent circumstances. But by and large, if you are feeling like, hey, I am so stressed, or I am so rageful, or I am so sad, or I am so angry, or I am so anything that impacts your quality of life day to day, it is no one else's responsibility to do that for you, because nobody can do it for you. You are the only one that can help you, even if that help is advocating for help.
Right. And I think the thing that might sound a little harsh, but I'd rather, if you're going to hear it about someone that isn't you, and take the moment to reflect in case it happens to apply to you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are someone who has that stress, who has mental distress in one way or another, whether that is anxiety or rage or general dissatisfaction and depression, you know, XYZ, name it. If that is impacting your ability to live your life, it is also impacting the people around you. So by not taking care of it, by not sort of taking responsibility and managing it and facing it, you are making other people's lives worse, and people that you probably care about, because you're probably not telling strangers your deepest, darkest thoughts. You're probably telling the people that you love those things.
We're also more apt to take frustrations out on the people that we're closest to and love.
Right.
Like, you think of some of the worst things that you have seen said, like, pick your favorite TV show character. I don't know. They always have an arc. They always have a bad day. There's always an episode with that. Think of who it is that they're yelling at. They're not yelling at the stranger on the bus.
Right.
Or the cashier or anything like that. They're yelling at their spouse, their kid, their brother, their friend, their parent. Fill in the blank. Because there is a comfort there that you're able to do that. But just because you feel like you can does not mean that you should.
No. And if you're comfortable, great. Tell them that you're struggling or that it's impacting you or that things are hard. And then let that comfort boost you forward into dealing with it and not a... Don't isolate yourself because you're afraid to say something, but also don't let that ruin all the relationships you have before you can fix them.
And with John, he didn't have any other relationships. There was nobody else that he could quote unquote take this out on.
Right.
And then he didn't take it out. He didn't get it out. He didn't do anything. Right. I picture him festered. As the whisper yelling, like in his office with the door closed, like with his music playing.
Well, and even so, even if we do have those issues, even if you're getting angry, stressed, anxious, depressed, you still have to communicate that. If someone calls me ugly and stupid,
give me their fucking number.
First of all, I know I would never give you their number because you'd walk right up one side of them and right down the other.
As I would, as I should, damn it.
As you should. But if they do that to me, and it really hurts my feelings because it would, and I don't tell them that, and they thought it was a funny joke and didn't realize that I took it seriously, it's not on them to apologize. They don't know it upset me at all. And granted, I mean, if it was something like that, they'd probably know it would upset you. But like,
right.
Anything that had to do with John's family, his wife, who, listen, I think anybody who has seen somebody deteriorate mentally knows that there is some anger that comes with that because they're not either putting together that it's you, they're not having the same filters, they're maybe not being as sensitive or kind as they might otherwise be. You hear a lot about it with people whose family members have dementia or the way that, you know, syphilis might make them treat you where you're like, I'm fucking taking care of you. Why are you doing this to me?
Mm-hmm.
It's still your responsibility to deal with.
Yeah, and it's almost like she could have also probably benefited from the same services John needed.
Oh, clearly. So it's just, that part is frustrating to me and difficult. But I don't really think that anybody else in his life was an imminent danger. I mean, clearly he went 36 years without doing it again.
But you count in prison too?
Oh yeah, I'm counting prison too. Because listen, people get in fights in prison.
He liked board games.
Yeah, that tracks.
In prison. He was rocking those.
Well, those have rules. Oh, so, he was probably good at accounting in those.
I bet he wanted to be the banker in Monopoly.
Oh, every fucking time, man.
What a bastard. But he counted it wrong because he sucked at it.
Oh, yeah.
Swiped a few buckaroos for himself.
Well, why not? Well, actually, there's a big guy hanging out and looming whose turn is next that he's probably why not. But I wouldn't doubt it. So it's just an interesting psych profile. It is a devastating case. That family did not deserve any of that. And neither did Dolores. She just wanted a nice, quiet husband. She wanted someone who would listen to classical music and wear his suits and be a stand-up guy and go to church with.
But there is, I think this case is a lot of things, but it's also sort of like illuminating the red flags of you are serving nobody by saying nothing.
Right.
If you are burying it deep and not acknowledging what's frustrating you or willing to do anything about it, like you're not saintly for that.
No. Burying it until you're buried with it doesn't make you better than someone who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a great advertisement for
BetterHelp. Today's sponsor.
Today's sponsor. Yes, exactly. But getting seriously, checking in with yourself. The electric jelly between our ears is weird, you guys, mm-hmm. and it does things we wish it wouldn't, and it's also the coolest thing in the world, and sometimes it sucks. And it's worth talking to somebody about what's going on, and if you end up feeling like you don't need it, cool, do it like once a month as a cute little check-in. Do what you right. gotta do, but you gotta take care of you.
Well, and my take on this has always been, if something is gonna happen, if shit hits the fan, you're not gonna wanna start fresh with someone then.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to have someone that you're like, I trust you. You have a pretty good basis of what's happening in my life. All right, now something happened. I don't want to have to take 3 hours to explain to you who Jean is, because she's my mom's ex-boyfriend's cousin's daughter-in-law who happens to own everything in our family. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to have to take this time right now in crisis to do that work.
Yeah.
So get that relationship secured. Find someone you like. Remember, it's like dating. You might not find the right person at first. Just make a little Google Doc of all the things you want them to know and keep going until you find someone you like.
Or if you're John, you just find someone that you like and maybe you don't hit it off right, but then you're just fucking insistent.
Oh,
and
yeah,
you keep
yeah.
popping up and you wear them down. And then she's like, oh, you know him.
That's one persistent love. Don't see a therapist who sticks with you if you're doing that. Don't do that. Don't see a therapist if they're like, all right, I guess now we are a good fit. You're right.
It's consistent. We yeah. love it.
So definitely check that out. Definitely talk to your people. And dare I say, read the newspapers that the smartest people in the world read. Let's talk about Bat Boy. Let's talk about John List. And let's Google our neighbors.
Let's do it.
Wow. I love Google. I love Wanda. Hashtag we love Wanda.
And her vision.
And her vision. I see it. Baby girl, I was born to see your visions.
And we love you guys. And we love that you stuck around with us on this series and this last episode here. We are putting John List to bed now. I am
good night.
Retiring. I am, dare I say, closing my tabs. And wow. I am closing out of the 30 pages that I've written that I hope is saved. And I am just feeling very grateful for all of you. And if you liked what you heard and you want to keep hearing it, we think that you should follow the podcast. We think you yeah. should tell a friend. We think you should rate, review, subscribe. We think that you should give us 5 stars because yeah. we love you.
And we love reading them. They really make our day.
They make our whole day. We love reading everything that you guys write to us, especially when it's nice.
Yeah.
And we're kissing you all on the cute little nose. And if Abby looks at her clock,
I would tell you that it's time to look at our Instagram and our link tree below. Where you could see the people, the places, the things that we talk about. Also, you'd find our Venmo, our PayPal, if you wanted to donate fiscally to the pod, and our email if you wanted to reach out and tell us about any recommendations, cases near and dear to your heart, or just thoughts and feelings. And if you want to let us know that you did find a therapist, because we would love that for you. But in the meantime, if I look at my watch this time, that was
About time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye.
I love Wanda.
Oh, Wanda.